I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views. Believe it or not, there are people to this very day that deny the Holocaust against the Jewish people as perpetrated by Nazi Germany in the 20th century. Dr. Andrew E. Mathis, aka Thames Darwin, and Marlon Ettinger, join us on this edition of the program to unravel the curious world of Holocaust denial. Now, if you're unfamiliar with Dr. Mathis, well, let's just say he is exactly the type of person to help us dive into this strange and murky world, and moreover, to debunk it. For years, Dr. Mathis has been fighting against Holocaust denial, and has even gone into the weeds by talking to and debating people within the subculture of Holocaust deniers. If you've ever wondered how Holocaust denial is even a thing, how it can even exist in the world we know today, well, we'll try to answer that question on this edition of Parallax Views. And now, on to the conversation with Dr. Andrew Mathis, aka Thames Darwin, and Marlon Ettinger. Welcome to Parallax Views. First time guest, Dr. Andrew Mathis, and joining us, returning guest Marlon Ettinger, a great friend of the show. How are you guys doing today?
Good, thanks, JG. How are you?
How you doing, JG?
I'm doing pretty good, although we're going to be talking about a very dark and probably downer of a topic. I don't know what effect it will have on my mood. We're going to be talking about Holocaust denial. And Andrew, this is a topic that you've covered on your own blog, Thames Darwin, and also through a blog called Holocaust Controversies, which I believe is a collective of multiple different writers. Maybe you could tell us a little about your interest in the topic and the Holocaust Controversies blog.
So the Holocaust Controversies blog was founded in 2006. The primary founder was a guy that was at the time a grad student and is currently a senior lecturer at the University of Exeter in history. His name is Nick Terry. And he invited myself, along with four other people, to start the blog in 2006, mainly as an exercise in kind of pooling our resources together in terms of combating Holocaust denial online. But most of the people that had been invited in 2006 were people that had already been doing this for several years. And I'd become involved when an organization called the Holocaust History Project was founded in the late 90s. And that was actually founded in part to assist Deborah Lipstadt in defending her suit from David Irving. And I had been invited there mainly just through sort of attention to the activism that I had been doing online at that point.
It's really interesting. Before this show, I was searching for more information on the Holocaust Controversies blog, and I noticed a bunch of these, or at least one, Holocaust denial website was like, why are these people at this blog so obsessed with us? And I'm like, well, you know, the things you guys are pushing, it's really dangerous. To me, that's why it's worth covering this topic, even if Holocaust denial is a seemingly fringe phenomena. I don't know what you guys think of that, though.
Yeah, well, I suppose a good question to counter that, the type of people who make those claims, is why are you so obsessed? You know, say it right back to them. But I will say about the Holocaust Controversies blog, I'm not involved in it at all. But I first encountered Holocaust denial, you know, years ago online, of course, on forums and stuff. And I never really bought it, but I would often argue there's a lot in the Holocaust Controversies blog. It was like indispensable. It's enormously comprehensive. And I didn't know it was like 4 or 5 people. That makes a little more sense. When I first found it, I thought, who could be doing all that incredible work?
Yeah, none of us could possibly do it alone. Although I think that one or two of us could perhaps do it alone, just because you'll see, in particularly in refuting denial online, a couple of people have done. Sergei Romanov, in particular, has really done kind of yeoman's work over the last couple of years in being really proactive, being involved in Twitter and Reddit, and sort of jumping in whenever it's possible for him to do so.
Yeah, I mean, it is just absolutely everywhere. And to your point, JG, about whether or not it's a fringe phenomenon, I sort of actually don't think that Holocaust denial is a fringe phenomenon, unfortunately. And I think that's something that people, I mean, you know, it's everywhere, but people often think it's a mad opinion that just comes out of nowhere, held only by crazy people. And it definitely isn't. I don't say that to endorse it in any way. I just think it's part of a political project, Holocaust denial. And that's why it's so, you know, it's exists so much. It's difficult to, I mean, you can refute everything, of course, but you can't definitively refute it because the whole project is not about any search for truth, that project being Holocaust denial.
I was going to say, it's interesting the approach that you've taken, Dr. Mathis, because I know you mentioned Deborah Lipstadt, and she has sort of said there's no point even really necessarily trying to debunk or debate Holocaust deniers, because that's elevating them to a position of being worth debating. You know, it's like debating a flat earther. It seems like you take a different approach. Why is that? I'm just curious.
Well, I think that one of the things that myself and the people that I've been working with for, you know, 20 years now realized was that the internet was going to be both a real blessing and a real curse in terms of the established history and defending it and building on it versus people that were dead set on tearing it down to the best of their ability. So, you know, I had first encountered Holocaust denial on talk radio. AM talk radio in Philadelphia, where I grew up and where I live now. And, these were very much fringe characters. One or two of them could sort of evoke an air of respectability, but by and large, most of them were overt neo-Nazis. And so they weren't going to get much traction that way. But their ability to find greater audiences and to sort of slip their discourse into genuine conversations about history, we recognized was going to be much greater with the internet. And I think that the way that you see this is two examples jump to mind. The first is when Pat Buchanan is writing about Ivan Domaniuk during the trial in Israel in the late 1980s, even back then, he is parroting talking points from the Institute for Historical Review, specifically the impossibility of killing with diesel gas is the trope that he picks up on. And much more recently.
Real quickly, you could maybe explain to my listeners who are unfamiliar who Domaniuk was and why this case is sort of I think it's actually important because it says a lot about Pat Buchanan, who for years was allowed on MSNBC while he was appearing on white supremacist radio shows like the Political Cesspool and all this other garbage.
Completely mainstream guy. Yeah.
Marlon, go ahead.
Oh, no, go ahead, Professor. I was just saying he's a completely mainstream guy, Buchanan.
Oh, yeah.
He has these views.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. I mean, and the thing about Buchanan – well, you had asked about Domaniuk. Domaniuk was a Ukrainian-American. He had emigrated to the United States after being in a DP camp after the war. He was an auto worker for years. He was retired by the time that he sort of appeared on the radar of the Office of Special Investigations, which is the wing of the United States government that's dedicated to searching for Nazi war criminals. And he was on a list that had been provided by the people in the Soviet Union of death camp guards that were still at large. And it was decided that at the OSI that they were going to go after Domaniuk. He was famously then stripped of his citizenship and deported to Israel, which had established in the Eichmann trial in the 1960s its authority to try war criminals, that basically it was going to get its first shot whenever that it seemed appropriate. The problem was that overzealous prosecution, bad information, probably from the very beginning out of the Soviet Union, the determination ultimately, despite the fact that Demjanjuk was convicted initially, was that he was in fact not guilty of the charges that were brought against him in Jerusalem. So he was ultimately acquitted, only to be then tried again in Germany at the very end of his life for the actual things that he had done. It's a little bit inside baseball, but at the end of the day, what they had gotten wrong in Israel was what camp he had been a guard at and when. And that was but, you know, in a judicial proceeding, that's enough to throw a case out. He was a very celebrated figure on the far right in the United States from the very beginning, but he was not the first one. And Buchanan had been on that bandwagon the entire time. Whenever a Nazi war criminal would be identified in the United States and they would begin proceedings to strip that person of his citizenship, Buchanan would be out there in the right-wing press talking about how, you know, for how long are we going to persecute these people? Don't we recognize that by and large most of them had no choice? They were fighting the larger fight against communism, and if they ended up on the quote-unquote wrong side, you know, who are we really to judge? That kind of thing. And ultimately, I mean, it got him censured by William F. Buckley, along with Joseph Sobrin, who was an overt Holocaust denier. They were two of the two regular columnists for the National Review. Sobrin was eventually fired. I don't remember if Buchanan was fired or not, but he was censured.
There were a lot of characters within that National Review milieu that got censured. Peter Brimlow is another one. I don't know if he ever got into the Holocaust denial side of things, but he swims within the same poisonous waters, if you will.
Absolutely.
You know, I wanted to comment on Marlon's point before we get more into the history of how Holocaust denial starts to crop up. Marlon, you said that you think it's more mainstream than people would like to admit. I don't know that I see a lot of mainstream figures on the right explicitly endorse Holocaust denial, but I do notice a lot who will bring up a common talking point that Holocaust deniers trot out, namely that, you know, yes, Hitler killed 6 million, but what about Stalin? No one ever talks about Stalin and Mao. I always see that in both the fringe and the mainstream right.
Yeah, it's sort of like that the double genocide theory, which I know is very controversial and something else to get into, but I think it actually is. I don't think it is just that, and this sort of gets into the history, and I'd love for Andrew to talk about it more because he probably knows it deeper. But the roots of American Holocaust now, these were people that were very influential in the conservative movement and were, you know, people like Barnes, who his books were taught in universities, or
Harry Elmer Barnes, yeah.
Right. Or people like, you know, Willis Cardo or Henry Regnery, who, you know, the Regnery Publishing House, which still exists today, and but I think it publishes D'Souza's books, right? Regnery. They published tons of conservative books, and they, you know, in the 20th century after the war, they were publishing stuff that, if not outright Holocaust denial, was certainly revisionist and flirted with the same tropes.
And definitely so, anti-Semitic.
Definitely, yeah. So that's sort of more what I mean when I say that it's mainstream. It's not that people are being overt about it with, you know, within mainstream conservatism today necessarily, but they're very comfortable with the ideas and they associate with people and they don't expel people that they know have the idea that and that they know believe these things.
I was going to note real quickly, since you mentioned Regnery, William H. Regnery II is actually the founder of the National Policy Institute, which was the white supremacist, white nationalist think tank that gave rise to characters like Richard Spencer in the 21st century so far.
Yeah, I wanted to say two things about the mainstream thing, just sort of jumping on Marlon's point. The first is actually slightly unrelated. It's just kind of a strangely a defense of the Regnery family, which is that William Regnery II actually was kind of disowned by the family, at least publicly. And so the actual publishing company Regnery, although I think that they're still pretty reprehensible in their own way, they are not actively publishing Holocaust Denial or involved with the NPI. But William Regnery II very much is, and he is therefore very much following in the footsteps of the initial sort of vision of that publishing company. The second thing that I wanted to mention was Chuck Johnson. So Matt Gaetz, who is a big Trump supporter in the House of Representatives, he's a rep from Northern Florida. He brought Chuck Johnson to the State of the Union address in 2019, and Chuck Johnson is a Holocaust denier. I mean, but he is, you know, he's not one of these sort of, you know, tinfoil on hat Holocaust deniers saying, well, Hitler didn't do anything wrong. He's saying, well, I'm not a Holocaust denier. I just think that the death toll was maybe 1 million rather than 6 million. And that has a corrosive effect, not just because obviously you have a member of the House of Representatives bringing this guy to the State of the Union address, but more importantly, probably to the overall discourse, is that he's introducing a point that on its surface seems reasonable. Like, so what if the death toll is 1 million or 6 million? It just is terrible either way that you cut it. And of course, on the one hand, that's true. But on the other hand, there's a reason why we use the figure 6 million, and it's borne out by the historical research done over the last 75 years. And if you let that thin edge of the wedge get in without pushing back on it, then what's going to come next is, you know, dickering back and forth about, you know, gas chamber technology and written Hitler orders and all kinds of arcana that, you know, people that are familiar with the history know the answers to, but people that aren't can be very easily persuaded to begin to sort of rethink what they think that they know. The problem with the topic of the Holocaust generally is that it is there's a lot of moving parts, and most people have a broad idea of what happened and very little understanding of the day-to-day operation and how it unfolded.
Marlon, anything you want to add to that before I move on to my next sort of question or point for the topic?
Yeah, I think that, you know, that's exactly right, Andrew. The Holocaust, in a word, it was complicated, you know. And I guess, you know, like, part of the problem is there is films and books that sort of sensationalize and make it lurid. Like, you had that show just now, what's it called, The Hunters, that, you know, portrayed a sort of human chess game death match in Auschwitz, which obviously never happened. And this stuff, or, you know, in like Schindler's List, using elements from one camp and another. And that historical inaccuracy, people jump on it, I think. Bad faith actors, of course. But they make these points that, oh, they seem reasonable. Like, oh, well, that never happened. So then, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, one thing I wanted to get into was, and this is going to seem like a ridiculous question, but I wanted to ask, how do we define Holocaust denial? Because you'll come up against these denialists and they'll say, well, I'm not a Holocaust denier. I'm a revisionist, and I just question, you know, the gas chambers. Or they'll quibble over the numbers, as you pointed out. Oh, maybe it was 1 million instead of 6 million. So, Dr. Mathis, maybe we could define our terms a little bit, just because these people can be very slippery.
Yeah. So basically, we would say that Holocaust denial is has like four prongs to it, but the fourth prong is the weakest one of all. It's the equivalent of A, E, I, O, and U, and the fourth prong is sometimes Y, basically. But the three main prongs are what we would say are number, method, plan. So number of fatalities, with the mainstream estimates ranging between 5 and 6 million. There are some mainstream estimates that are slightly less than 5 million. I've seen at least one that's more than 6 million. But the range, I think, most people are comfortable saying, most people sort of who have really studied it are comfortable saying 5.5 to 6 million. Second is methods, that among other methods, that gas chambers were used in certain camps set up by the Nazis in Poland and occupied Poland. And the third is the plan. And plan itself is a little bit weak just because a lot of the initial stage of the Holocaust, basically until early 1942, was ad hoc and was being carried out under a lot of independent initiative by people in the field rather than orders being given from the top down. But certainly by early 1942, there is a plan underway. It is no longer an ad hoc procedure unfolding. So those are the three main ones. And the last one is that most people are doing this to launch an attack on Jews, but they're doing it in virtually all cases, doing it as a way of attacking what they see as legitimacy for the state of Israel. They figure, okay, well, we attack the Holocaust narrative, then we attack one of the key underpinnings of the state of Israel. That's a mistaken point, by the way, just because obviously Zionism goes back 50 years before the Holocaust, and maybe the Holocaust might have sort of expedited the process of establishing a state, but there had already been proposals under the on the table up until that point. And the second thing, you know, it's becoming sort of increasingly clear, I think, to a lot of people who are fighting this battle every day, is that you're not going to get a lot of vociferous defenses of Israel from people fighting back against Holocaust denial as you would have 25 years ago. So there's a lot less willingness for people to sort of rise to that bait. That's both a good thing and a bad thing. I think it's a good thing just because I think that the emergence of more resistance to certain policies in Israel among the Jewish population is a sort of a net good, but a bad thing in that because of this disinterest about Israel, because so much of the rhetoric of denial is couched within criticisms of Israel, it ends up being less provocative than it was when there was sort of more uniform support.
And the next question I have, diving a little bit into the history of Holocaust denial, is when does this really start? Because I think this goes back even before the famous David Irving trial, you know, the Earl Morris documentary about Fred, I believe his name is Luchter. I believe all of this actually has a rather long history going back shortly after World War II.
Roland, you want to take that one?
I think that's a better question for you to answer, actually, Dr. Mathis. I think you know it a little better.
Yeah, no, I'm happy to do it. So, I mean, you get a certain denial-like thing during the war itself, which is war criminals claiming either that they were not involved or that they didn't know that there was a program going on. Very few of them denied there was an extermination program. The primary thing that they did was claim that they were unaware of it, and they used that defense to varying extents. But really, the person that establishes Holocaust denial after the war is Willis Cardo. He does it virtually single-handedly, if only because he's able to mobilize figures on the right to an extent that people are not. And it's actually just sort of a fascinating story about how he gets involved in the first place. Cardo had been, you know, Cardo's a World War II vet. He died, I think, last year or the year before. But he was a World War II vet and but had, you know, been on the far right, you know, for his life at that point. But he drifts into the orbit of this guy named Ulrich Varange is the pseudonym of the guy, but the guy's actually
Francis Parker Yawkey.
That's the guy, exactly. And he writes this very famous book called Imperium, which is basically like an ur-text of the national Bolshevist movement. Like Dugin and people like that today are sort of acting out the philosophy that Yawkey had put forward in Imperium, you know, 75 years ago. Yawkey had actually started out being on the prosecution team at Nuremberg. And it seems like what he did was sort of insinuate himself in there so he could begin to undermine the cases against war criminals. When he was found out from operating on a false passport, he came back to the United States. He was in a holding cell in San Francisco. He was visited by Willis Cardo. And then the next day he committed suicide by cyanide capsule. And it's always raised the question of whether Cardo had infiltrated, cyanide into the cell that Yawkey ended up taking, although nobody's ever been able to prove it one way or the other. But after Yawkey dies, Cardo is there to rally his Yawkey supporters, who were not insignificant in number, and who involved the sort of the nascent far right wing in the United States post-war, as well as important figures in Europe, who a lot of whom were either accused Nazi war criminals or were people that had been fleeing justice. You know, people like Léon Degrelle, who was a Walloon head of an SS unit, and Otto Ernst Roemer, a lot of people that were living in exile in Spain and Portugal because there was no extradition. So you have gathered together by Cardo people on the far right in the United States, former Nazis and fugitives, who are working together to begin to promulgate this message that what you are being told about what was done to the Jews during the war is false. And the way that they deny it ranges anywhere from it just plain didn't happen to what we were talking about a little while ago, which was, you know, to sort of say, well, yeah, what was done to the Jews was bad, but what Stalin was doing was worse. And furthermore, did you know that most of the people that were doing Stalin's killing were Jews to begin with? And, you know, sort of that kind of moral argumentation, for lack of a better term. And Cardo ends up, for a short period, infiltrating the mainstream right in the United States. But there's a very clear moment at which both the John Birch Society, where all of these guys end up being at one point or another before moving on. It's like a clearinghouse for neo-Nazis. The Birch Society kicks them out. Usually they've been kicked out of Buckley's organization first, and then from there they go to the Birch Society. And from the Birch Society, they end up just going to neo-Nazi organizations outright. And that's what Cardo does. Cardo ends up first falling out of Buckley's orbit and then being kicked out of the John Birch Society. And then finally he emerges first as a with the Wallace campaign in the 1960s as heading up Youth for Wallace. And that's where he becomes politically active.
So he was pushing for segregation.
Oh yeah. Yeah, absolutely. But it's Cardo, just to sort of finalize the point, it's Cardo that founds the Institute for Historical Review, which is the organization that tries, that first, for the first time, tries to mainstream denial. And in doing that, it brings within its orbit two very important figures. The first is Irving, who we already talked about a little bit. And the other one is Robert Faurisson, the French Holocaust denier who makes a huge splash in France in the 1970s. By saying that he doesn't believe that there were gas chambers and making his argument in favor of it. And what's far less important than what Faurisson actually says or does is the attention that's given to him by virtue of making the argument that he does. And the people that end up giving him that attention, who are sort of paradoxically are people on the far left in France who have are sort of like hardcore unreconstructed Trotskyists and Stalinists who are not buying any sort of any quote unquote propaganda coming out of Eastern Europe because, you know, there's no longer any sort of monopoly on the truth in those countries now that they moved away from more orthodox forms of Marxism, basically. But all those people, most of these people end up drifting toward the right. You mentioned one of you mentioned Barnes earlier, and Barnes was, you know, very much a sort of a traditional liberal, you know, like a center-to-left intellectual, and came into denial by sort of through the militant pacifist movement after World War II, and ends up drifting right on that basis in close to the same way that Henry Ford does after World War I. Ford becomes politically active by seeking to support peace first during World War I and then immediately afterward in a much bigger sort of broad push for war prevention. And he drifts into anti-Semitic conspiracy theory by being told by people at the Paris Peace Conference that the Bolsheviks are all Jews, and it's like sort of off to the races from there. Barnes, it seems, was less overtly anti-Semitic, but certainly got roped into the denial narrative in pretty much the same way that Ford got radicalized in his own way after World War I.
Well, I'd like to make some just editorial comment on Willis Cardo, because I actually, and I've talked about this in other episodes, mainly with anti-fascist activist Shane Burley. People can check out those episodes. I'm very open about the fact that I was in my teens sort of being courted by people within Cardo's orbit, namely a guy named Michael Collins Piper. It was it's very embarrassing to me that I went through like a far right wing phase or dabbling in the far right as sort of a misguided libertarian youth. But Cardo, I think people don't realize just how important he is to the history of the American far right. He's in a way different from someone like William Luther Pierce, who was calling for just straight up revolution. And of course they worked together at times, other times they disliked each other. But Cardo took a different approach. Cardo was almost like a reformist, like he wanted to sort of worm his way into the political system. And he does this through organizations like the Liberty Lobby and his newspapers, The Spotlight and American Free Press. And what's very scary to me about these newspapers and magazines, I remember in high school, in my newspaper class, someone used AFP as a source. And I had to explain to them what AFP was. They didn't know because Cardo was able to sort of make newspapers and magazines that if you didn't really look and dive too deeply into them, you wouldn't necessarily know upon first glance what was really going on and just how far right it really was. He even tried to create a sort of alliance with certain leftists with these outlets he made. So a very dangerous and very important figure within the far right and its history, in my opinion. With that being said, I want to kick it over to Marlon.
Yeah, I think that gets to a point of how denial has sort of evolved and where it is now. And I'd be interested in both your perspectives on where you think it is now. But before that, I'm interested, Dr. Mathis, knowing how close do you think people like Ernst Nolte was to these networks? Or did they have alternate networks? Because Ernst Nolte, for those who don't know, I don't think you'd exactly call him a Holocaust denier. He was a German historian who wrote books in the 80s, and there was a big debate over this where he was accused of trying to sort of give culpability to the Nazi period by saying it was this defense against the Soviets that everything Hitler did he was forced to do because of the Soviet threat. And I'd be interested to know how closely you think that ties into Holocaust denial. Is it Holocaust denial, or what are your thoughts on that?
Well, it's Holocaust relativization at the very least. And it's like you mentioned double genocide before, which is a huge sort of movement in the Baltic states and in Hungary, which is, trying to make the argument essentially that not only was did the Nazis commit genocide against the Jewish population as well as several other pre-identified populations, but that the Soviet occupations amounted to genocide, if not through overt, direct mass killing, then at the very least through policies that were anti-national and that specifically targeted national identity in these countries through mass deportations and things like that. And we can have a discussion about what the Soviets did in these countries and the extent to which, it might or might not be properly defined as genocide, but that doesn't make a difference to what the Nazis did and why they did it and how they did it. And for that matter, sort of most importantly in these countries, the cooperation of the people, of certain people in those countries to go along with the Nazis program. And that's part of the reason. Just I don't want to go too far afield on that. Well, what Nolte was involved in was something called the Historikerstreit, the historian struggle. Basically, a left-wing group of historians led by Jürgen Habermas and the right-wing led by him, by and large, as well as Joachim Hoffman and a couple of other important sort of mainstream conservative historians. And I think that you summarized their point pretty well. I mean, Nolte basically is saying that Hitler is a reaction to Stalin, and that what Hitler does is specifically anti-communist, and that the reason why Jews ended up being targeted to such a massive extent is because he sees Judaism and communism as essentially the same thing. Hitler, that is, not Nolte. That's very close to a lot of the arguments that you see Holocaust deniers make. To his benefit, I would say, Nolte has two things going for him. First is, and he's dead now, but a couple of these people are still alive. But Nolte had two things going for him. First, his scholarship on fascism is actually really good and important, and he makes an excellent point about how the Nazis were definitely mobilized by anti-Marxism. I think he makes – if he made that point alone, everybody would pretty much leave him alone. Second of all, he never got directly involved with Holocaust deniers and basically made it clear that he thought that they were bad people. The same cannot be said for Joachim Hoffman. Hoffman had actually I can't remember the particulars, unfortunately, but he had, like, you know, co-published with some Holocaust deniers or appeared at a conference or something like that. And so he had actually been actively investigated by the authorities in Germany. And he was the most famous case of one of the people on the right-wing part of that debate in Germany in the 1980s, I guess it was. But I'm sure he wasn't the only one. I mean, that's, you know, that he was the one that sort of showed up on everybody's radar was probably directly proportional to the fact that he was also one of the best-known historians at the time. If Nolte had been involved to that extent, that would be all you would know about him today, basically, and that's not the case. But I'm not sure I answered the question, did I?
I think you did. I was more interested in, like, whether or not he had links to those networks that we were just discussing at all.
Yeah, not that I know of.
Yeah, which if no seems the case. And I was also interested. I know recently there's a controversy with a professor. What's his name? Jorg Babrowski, who is sort of a disciple of Nolte's, and he's a current professor at Humboldt. I was wondering if you knew about any connections there.
I don't. In fact, I've never even heard that name, although I have a friend that's a student at Humboldt right now. I'm going to have to ask her about it.
Yeah. I think Babrowski is at Princeton now, but if you haven't heard of it, no point delving too deep into it, because I haven't heard much about it either. I think, you know, I always wonder what figures like this actually do believe, because I think the strategy, you know, has been for Holocaust deniers to put on their suit and tie, produce these slick newspapers or magazines like Cardo, and then you could even say go so far as to produce seemingly inoffensive scholarship.
Well, if I could real quickly, Marlon, I was just going to add, I don't know if we mentioned it with Cardo, but I always felt like his two main magazines, newspapers, were, as I mentioned, the Liberty Lobby and American Free Press. But I believe he sort of used those as gateways, a sort of gateway drug, not only to the Institute for Historical Review, which Dr. Mathis mentioned, but also his explicit revisionist and Holocaust denial publication, The Barnes Review. So there's definitely sort of this attempt to ease people into it by a figure like Cardo. And I often think to myself, I wonder if Cardo actually believed in what he was pushing, or if he thought to himself, well, it's too bad we couldn't have got 6 million more. Sometimes I feel like these figures are very dishonest about what they believe, but we can't really get inside their minds.
Yeah, I mean, I've struggled with that question as well, as to the extent to which the people that are out there sort of parroting these points actually believe them or not. I think in Carter's case, it's likely that he did not believe them, and that he was just sort of pushing it because he was very much concerned and attempting to revitalize fascism and make it a viable political option in the United States. But he couldn't do that with the Holocaust. I mean, there was just too many bodies standing in the way. And so the primary goal becomes, among people like Cardo, to reassert the possibility of National Socialism, you know, specifically, or at least fascism generally, as a way of organizing society, and by making it seem just not as bad as it actually was. You make a great point about sort of easing people into it, and I think that there's a really important sort of way of looking at this issue that I think JG in particular probably would inform where you were at the time when you had contact with Piper, which is that if most thinking people figure out when they're in their teens or 20s that the way that the world has been portrayed to them up until that point is actually false, right? That power structures are different than what you've been told, that, you know, the meritocracy we're supposed to have in the United States doesn't really work for everybody, that, you know, that racism is really still a thing, you know, any number of ways that you become aware that something's not actually right, that the narrative that we're told in this country growing up is false in some pretty significant ways. There are people that are waiting, literally just out there in the world, waiting to find young men in particular who come to that realization and to reel them in with propaganda of one sort or another. And, you know, for those of us that were, you know, that were raised to, you know, believe that we're all in it together, and that we have a responsibility to people less fortunate than ourselves, and, you know, believe in things like charity and so on and so forth, you know, where we get pulled is probably going to be to the left. But there's a significant number of people, young men in particular, again, who are less politically inclined, maybe less altruistic naturally, whatever. But they're going to be told something about, you know, the Jews that that is going to get them curious. And then it's going to be a slow reeling in process, but they're going to get there eventually. And a guy like Cardo was an absolute master at that. I mean, he just really knew what he was doing and was therefore very able to get people aboard like that. You mean, you mentioned Pierce before. Yeah, I mean, Pierce and Cardo were both, they worked together in the Wallace campaign. And when the Wallace campaign was over, Cardo went, tried to go mainstream, and Pierce just, you know, openly declared himself a neo-Nazi and founded the National Alliance. I mean, so their paths were quite different in that regard, but, you know, but ideologically they were coming from exactly the same place.
Well, this last point on Cardo, I think we have to mention a particular case that I feel is very important. The Institute for Historical Review had to take on a Hungarian-born Jewish survivor of the Holocaust, sole survivor of his family's extermination at Auschwitz, Mel Mermelstein. Could you maybe talk a little bit about that case? Because it's the case where, in American court, it was basically declared that the Holocaust is a legally incontestable fact.
Yeah, so this was in California, where the IHR continues to operate today, although their connection to Holocaust denial is actually a lot more tenuous than it used to be, because the current director of the IHR had basically declared that he believes that the Holocaust happened. But that's a different story. So this is back in the 70s when it's being led by a guy named David McCaldin. David McCaldin was a Northern Irish expatriate who has drifted over to the far right via the National Front, basically, and come to the United States, probably brought by Cardo directly to head up the IHR. And he had the IHR was doing this thing then that they were putting ads in newspapers telling people they would pay $50,000 for proof that Jews were gassed at Auschwitz-Birkenau. Mermelstein had gotten involved. I forget the precise way that they got Mermelstein's name, but what they ended up doing was actually directly challenging Mermelstein publicly to prove his allegation that his family had been murdered, basically. And what he did was he provided the evidence they asked for, and they would not pay him, so he sued them. And he won. And when he won, part of what was in the judgment was judicial notice taken by the judge in the case that that the Holocaust happened, basically, you know, that it's not really subject to debate whether or not Jews were killed, you know, in enormous numbers during World War II, including by poison gas at Auschwitz, and that Mel Mermelstein's family was involved in it. I don't know how binding that sort of taking of judicial notice by that judge in California was, but it was definitely a blow to the IHR. I mean, I think I'm pretty sure that it was in the aftermath of that whole debacle on their part, that McCaldin was sort of ushered out of the organization, and people that were more sort of agreeable, and in that I mean Bradley Smith, Mark Weber, some of the people are still there right now, but definitely Weber and Smith come in after that are there to kind of try to recover the organization. But the Mermelstein case is a big deal in the IHR history, because it ends up being it really, really muddies their face in terms of what they had been trying up until that point to accomplish.
You mention Bradley Smith. That name rings a bell. Is that related to the Committee for Open Debate on the Holocaust? Well, I believe you've actually got into the weeds and argued with people from that so-called organization.
Yeah, no, I've gotten deep into the weeds with the people over there. So that was Bradley. Bradley died, I think, 2 years ago or 3 years ago now as well. He'd gotten involved in the whole thing via the IHR, and he had drifted over into creating his own organization and separating from Mark Weber, who at that point was firmly ensconced as the head of the IHR. This happened, I believe, in the 1990s. By the time Bradley came on my radar, he was already running Committee for Open Debate on the Holocaust and was not directly involved in the IHR anymore. But I went back and did the research and found out, you know, who was involved with whom and when and all that. And Bradley always had made the point that he was apolitical, that it wasn't a right-wing thing for him. And what was interesting about him was that a lot of the things that we know about Mark Weber – so Mark Weber is a fascinating character just in his own right. He's the head of the IHR. He's been there for probably close to 40 years now. And Weber is one of the very few Holocaust deniers who has an advanced degree in history. He got a master's in history from Indiana University, which is a – you know, it's like a public Ivy. So it's a good program, good education. But he has been involved in neo-Nazi organizations for his entire adult life. He was in Pierce's organization. He was in one of Cardo's organizations. He was a member at one time of the NSDAPAO run by this guy, Gary Lauck, in Nebraska, who, you know, was like always dressed in full regalia and speaks with a fake German accent. Like, these are the kind of people that Mark Weber has been involved with for his entire adulthood. He was arrested in Munich when he was an exchange student there, and when he was being brought in, he declared that he was a warrior for the Aryan race. This is the guy that heads the IHR today. But at the same time, this is a guy, while he continues to head the IHR and is dedicated to attacking Jews in any way that he can, he basically, as an historian, said, I can't make the case anymore that the Holocaust didn't happen pretty much the way that it is said that it happened, because the proof is just overwhelming, which is interesting in its own right, I guess, but also it underscores that if you can find people within the Holocaust denial movement who renounce the position of denial, it's valuable insofar as they sort of correct their mistakes. But if they renounce denial and still like hold their far right beliefs, including anti-Semitism, then you're able to make a different point about Holocaust denial, and that it's just not only is it obviously a form of anti-Semitism, but it's just bad history on top of it that doesn't take into account the ongoing academic debates about what actually happened and who was involved and what were the means, motive, and and execution of different events. But anyway, just to sort of reel myself back in, it was Bradley Smith who had revealed a lot of Mark Weber's past to a general readership, and that was part of his sort of presenting himself as apolitical. Whether it was true or not, I don't really know. He placed himself very often above the fray when there was a lot of infighting in these groups. There was a huge thing that happened in the early 1990s with the IHR where Cardo, the people working for the organization led by Mark Weber, tried to seize the organization away from Willis Cardo. There was a lawsuit. Mark Weber attempted to sell the mailing list to the Church of Scientology. I mean, it's a fascinating little story of what goes on inside this organization. Yeah, the IHR is from Mermelstein on, basically, it was really clear to everybody what the IHR was really about. Weber tried to sort of steer it back into a more respectable waters, and that's where it is pretty much today. But when the Mermelstein case happened, that was the exodus of the first sort of staff that worked there.
And I was going to kick it over to Marlon, because Dr. Mathis mentioned Holocaust deniers who eventually renounced Holocaust denial. There's one figure in particular you were telling me about who actually initially believed claims about Holocaust denial and then said, oh, no, I was completely wrong.
Yeah, and he's probably the most well-known in the small world of people who, you know, read about this stuff. But his name is Jean-Claude Pressac, and he was a French pharmacist. He, like many of these figures, have little interesting personal histories. He went through this process that you know, Dr. Mathis has sketched out a little. He saw some, he got convinced slowly by these arguments. He had an interest in the history. He read, was reading books and stuff wasn't adding up to him, he thought. And then he heard about Robert Florison, who had claimed that there were no gas chambers, no homicidal gas chambers. And he actually, you know, he was, to satisfy his interest in the subject, he went and met with Florison and became a collaborator with him in his research, as it was, for I think about 6 months. He would went to Poland, you know, to Auschwitz and Birkenau, and he was trying to establish evidence that there were no homicidal gas chambers. And he, with the authorities there, he, you know, he posed as not a denier. He posed as someone interested in researching. Then he got access to documents and blueprints of the original construction of the chambers. And slowly he became very convinced that, well, actually, as the reality is, they did exist. And then he wrote a long book, a couple of books actually, but a long book on the gas chambers, and sort of renounce that earlier position.
Dr. Mathis, is there anything you would like to add about that specific case?
No, that's the only thing that I would add is that, Pressack did, made an enormous contribution to what we know about Auschwitz, and that he did it basically with going in with the opposite intent. Is really kind of remarkable. But I mean, some of the documents that we regularly talk about today are documents that were first published in Pressack's book about Auschwitz. You know, documents that it's very difficult for Holocaust deniers to sort of to cope with. Like, you know, there's one of the documents that that Pressack published. I don't remember if he published it first, but he certainly published it probably most famously, at least in the circles surrounding Forreston, was a document that actually literally mentions gas chambers. And there are incredibly few of those documents because the Nazis were trying really hard to cover up what they were doing. And he found one in Auschwitz in the building office archives. And, you know, he basically in finding that and then in finding his approach was interesting, too. For Pressack, it was less important to find a smoking gun than it was to find an argument to be made about what was going on at Auschwitz that no other explanation could account for. Like, why do we have all of these gas tight doors and air ventilation systems in rooms that were being told are morgues? You don't actually need an airtight door on a morgue, for instance, you know. And so we have to weigh what the eyewitnesses say versus what the documents say, and what the, for that matter, what the chemical evidence says. And he drew the conclusion that basically common sense drew. And I think that it blew up in Forreston's face in a way that he was never really able to walk away from. He would always sort of try to suggest to the media or whoever was listening to him at the time that that Pressack had actually helped revisionists much more than he'd helped the actual historical record. But he published in the late 1980s. We probably know more about gassing at Auschwitz thanks to Jean-Claude Pressack than any other single person. That's just remarkable, just on its own.
Well, I don't think any discussion about the issue of Holocaust denial would be complete unless we got into the case of David Irving. And my understanding is that at one point David Irving was considered a respectable historian. Even when he got into Holocaust denial, there were people like Christopher Hitchens defending him on free speech grounds. What is the story of David Irving? Because I know there's a lot of misinformation and disinformation about his trial.
Marlon, do you want to take that one, or?
I'd like to ask a quick question though first, and this is something I'm unclear on. I've heard recently that David Irving may have walked back on denial or what he says about it. Is that true? Or
yeah, it is true.
So could, right. And to what extent? Completely or?
Sort of, well, him and David Cole are kind of in the same bin right now.
David Cole is sort of known as the Jewish Holocaust denier.
Right. Yeah. So David, and I know both of these guys, like, you know, I've actually met David Irving in person. I've had lengthy discussions online with David Cole. They both were where their ships went aground was on what's called Action Reinhardt, which was the extermination of the Jews of Poland in particular. So these are the camps Treblinka, Belzec, Sobibor. And 1.5 million Polish Jews are sent to these camps in 1942 to early 43 and disappear. Right. I mean, and so, you know, obviously the mainstream historiography says this is where the primary extermination of Polish Jewry took place was in these three camps. And this is – and there's – you know, there are, you know, intercepted telegrams about this. There's a very famous statistical report prepared by somebody in the SS. I mean, so we have a lot of documentation, and we have a very compelling group of eyewitnesses for what happened at these camps. And it's on that basis that we've constructed the history of what went on at these three camps. For both Cole and for Irving, they basically said that – after a certain period of time with the Reinhardt camps, they could no longer deny what had gone on there. There was no alternate explanation for what happened to 1.5 million Jews sent to those camps. Where they continued to sort of throw up a resistance is on accepting mass extermination at Auschwitz-Birkenau. And to be honest with you, I couldn't explain to you why they do that, because from the standpoint of where I am, I see at least as good a case, if not a better one, being made for Auschwitz than for the Reinhardt camps. But that's where these two guys are in their positions about denial. They accept Reinhardt. They continue to deny Auschwitz.
Right. And then as to Irving, you know, Irving was a British historian. He was not a historian by education, but he got into writing popular historical books. He wrote a famous book about the firebombing of Dresden, where he claimed that he had found that the death toll was much larger and constituted an atrocity by the Allies.
Kurt Vonnegut famously references that book in, I think, the introduction to the Slaughterhouse-Five. Although at the time, people don't mention this, but at the time, you know, we didn't know better about Irving. So it's hard to blame Vonnegut for that necessarily.
Oh, it's my sister who is in high school. She read that book recently, and I picked up her copy of the book, and it was very, you know, darkly funny to see David Irving's name in a book still being read. But yeah, he published, and so that's, I think that, though you say we didn't know about him, I think even at that point, it was part of this project that he had, which was to equate the atrocities of the Allies as just as bad as the Nazis. And he went along this route where he wrote, you know, he wrote biographies of Hitler, and he wrote one of, was it Goebbels or Himmler?
He wrote Goebbels. Was the one that sort of put him on the mainstream map for the controversy surrounding it was the Goebbels biography.
Right. And, you know, his project started off where he tried to absolve Hitler of responsibility. That was his the first sort of claim in his path towards outright Holocaust denial. He would make these outrageous claims that, you know, Hitler was the best friend of the Jews in Nazi Germany, and Hitler had no idea of this policy. But then eventually he sent it into Holocaust denial outright, and this controversy sort of came to a head when Deborah Lipstadt referred to Irving as a Holocaust denier. In her book, and he then sued her for this claim, which is another, you know, you mentioned there's a lot of misinformation about the trial. Deniers will often portray this trial as Lipstadt suing Irving for, you know, touching this taboo truth, but it was Irving that sued her. He wanted this to make his case, I think, and he was proven wrong. You probably know a lot more about that case, Dr. Mathis.
What
was your involvement exactly with the group?
I'm sorry?
What was that group that you were involved with that relates to the case again?
So when Deborah Lipstadt was sued, she reached out to, you know, sort of Jewish communities around the country seeking assistance because there was only so much money that that her publishing company was willing to put up. And it's a Penguin, I think. And because he was, you know, he was going for looking to basically bury not only her but Penguin for having published the book in the first place. He sued in the UK because he had a chance for better for a better judgment against her. But B, and this is the downside of it for him, was that if he lost, he was going to be forced to pay her defense. So she put a call out to the Jewish communities around the country. One of the people that responded was a man named Harry Mazal. Harry Mazal was a businessman from Mexican American from San Antonio, and he had at the time the largest private library in the world of books about the Holocaust, which he had come to very late in his life because Harry grew up not knowing he was Jewish despite his last name being Mazal. He found out much later on in his life that he was descended from Sephardic Jewry. And then he became involved in the organized Jewish community in San Antonio and was a big figure in it. And so when she put out the call, he donated money, but he also formed the Holocaust History Project. And then invited a number of important historians to join it, as well as just a number of activists like myself, to do a lot of the legwork. It was those people under the auspices of the Holocaust History Project that were responsible for providing expert reports in the Lipstadt trial. So one of the two expert reports from historians, the one from Robert Jan van Pelt, was assisted in part by the Holocaust History Project, and one of the chemical reports was produced entirely by a member of the Holocaust History Project. So, the point about Irving as a mainstream historian was that he was very much, I think, trying to establish himself in England as as the British version of a Nolte, of a right wing historian, looking to establish a dialogue about Nazi Germany and World War II that recognized the importance of fighting communism and the relative nature of Nazi crimes versus Soviet crimes and Western Allied crimes, as well as already said, to exculpate Hitler to the greatest extent possible.
So and you would agree with Marlin that Irving definitely had a right wing agenda to push.
Oh yeah. Yeah. I mean, he had literally just referred to himself as a quote unquote mild fascist in a newspaper interview back in the 70s. So he was open about his political leanings. Absolutely.
As to the openness, I think that sort of circles back also a little bit to the point earlier about, you know, all this stuff being a little more mainstream. Like, you know, there was the case when Hitler's diaries, which later turned out to be, they weren't his diaries, they were a hoax, but when they were found, Andrew Neil, who people might know as the anchor on the BBC, the Scottish man who's, you know, very crisp and no nonsense, he was then the editor for the Sunday Times, and he hired David Irving to handle these diaries and to, you know, so there's just another little example of that. But go on, JJ.
Oh, I'm sorry, if I could just throw one thing in. The book that David Irving wrote after his book about Dresden, but before he started writing about the Third Reich, was a book on the Hungarian uprising in 1956. His translator for that book was Sebastian Gorka's mother.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Wait, wow. Could you repeat that? I missed that.
The translator that David Irving used he needed somebody to translate from, you know, from Magyar into English when he was doing a book about Hungary because he didn't have any language experience. The translator that he hired is Sebastian Gorka's mother.
Wow.
Yeah, he mentions her by name. I mean, it's indisputable. I mean, it's just a known fact.
So I guess we should get into the outcome of the Irving case for those that don't know.
Yeah, he lost bad. He lost bad in part because he essentially tried to prove that he wasn't a Holocaust denier by denying the Holocaust, you know, which seems kind of counterintuitive, but that was what he tried.
I guess that's the old strategy they often use. Like, how can I deny something that didn't happen? You know,
right. Yeah. Yeah, no, exactly. I mean, and he ended up defending himself, which was, you know, just monumentally stupid. And look, I mean, the guy, I'm going to give him his due. At the time that he was doing normal history books, which is a short period, about 10, 15 years between the 1960s and the 1970s. He was a heavily biased historian, but by and large, he was a good historian. He did archival research. You know, some of the documents about the Holocaust in Latvia that I've looked at in a lot of detail are documents that he published for the first time, that Irving did. And, you know, that's a fact that all of us within this historical community have to deal with every day. He was a major figure for a certain period of time. And he was legitimate insofar as he was recognized by other historians as having of his work having value. But he just at some point he just took a much larger bite out of the relativization of Nazi war crimes and went into denial to such a great extent that that he undermined what could have really been a Nolte-esque kind of career, where you would recognize the historian for his bias, but nevertheless for his value as an historian. And just he blew it, basically, is what the story is with Irving.
And really briefly, my understanding is that Irving really crossing the line comes with him reading something called the, and I'm probably botching the name, the Luchter Report, by Fred A. Luchter. And this report is interesting because I always hear Holocaust deniers talking about Prussian blue. I hear neo-Nazis talk about that term. Maybe you could explain the Luchter Report and this weird obsession with Prussian blue.
Did you want me to do that?
If you could, Andrew, yeah. And then Marlon, I'll kick it over to you.
So yeah, so part of, again, I mean, then this is really sort of arcane information, but the compound that was used for homicidal gassing in Auschwitz was called Zyklon B. It's like a carrier. Basically, it looks like cat litter. And if you unseal it, though, it begins to outgas, to provide hydrogen cyanide gas. It's incredibly deadly, obviously. And the use of it at Auschwitz was basically sort of happened upon by accident, not really by accident, but like as a kind of an experiment. Like we're going to, you know, we've been told that they want us to start gassing prisoners. We don't have access to carbon monoxide, which is what other camps were using. Why don't we try this insecticide that we have lying around that we've been using to kill lice on people's clothing? Turns out it works. And so we do that. And where Leuchter comes in is in the case of a Canadian-German Holocaust denier named Ernst Zundel. Zundel was brought up on charges in Canada in 1985. The charge was spreading false news, which was an interesting way to charge him for denying the Holocaust. But
this Zundel is the same guy that sort of – he funded his Holocaust operations selling books about UFOs and secret Nazi bases in Antarctica, I believe.
The very same, yeah. Very same guy.
Odd crew of people.
Yeah, very. And I mean, I – at one point, I remember just years ago, and this is, you know, well, I'll tell you the rest of this story offline if you want to hear it. But I mean, I was contacted by his ex-wife at one point, by Zundel's ex-wife, and given just like a huge trove of the most bizarre information about the guy at the time. But I can't really talk about it because it's, you know, I've never been able to corroborate most of it. But yeah, I mean, it's just imagine what you do know about the guy, just like 100 times weirder. But so he defends himself basically by hiring Leuchter. Leuchter is a guy whose job it is back in the 1970s and 80s to go around to prisons in the United States and to bring their execution equipment up to speed, including gas chambers using cyanide. So he's a quote unquote expert. And so Zundel pays him money to go to Auschwitz. Leuchter, by the way, goes to Auschwitz on his honeymoon. And he goes into the remains of the gas chambers, because the thing to remember about the gas chambers at Auschwitz-Birkenau is that the SS destroyed them before they vacated the camp. So they're piles of rubble. So he goes in and steals samples from the gas chamber, brings them to a lab in the United States who tests them for cyanide. And while they turn up positive for cyanide, they don't turn up positive for cyanide at levels that Leuchter claims would indicate homicidal gassing. And that is the for the deniers, this is the great smoking gun. This is the proof that there was no gassing at Auschwitz-Birkenau. And Zundel is acquitted in his 85 case, by the way, but not because of the Leuchter report or anything like that. But getting back to Irving claimed that it was this report that really convinced him that what we had been told about Auschwitz and about the Holocaust generally was not true. Because there was now scientific evidence, essentially, that proved that it wasn't.
Yeah, and the level of scientific evidence is not very high, and not very high at all. There's a lot of basic mistakes in the report, like in one crematorium. There are samples that tested negative and positive. How do you reconcile that? If there was nothing there, they would all test negative. None would test positive.
Right. The other thing is that just you mentioned the Prussian blue. So, like I said before, like this stuff had been used at Auschwitz and in many other camps. Cyclone B, this is to delouse clothing, and when you're delousing clothing, you have the stuff out in the atmosphere of the delousing chamber for a solid 24 hours. And brick, despite looking quite solid, is actually very porous. And when you outgas hydrogen cyanide onto a brick wall, what happens is you get these deep blue stains called Prussian blue, which is a compound that's formed when some chemical reaction happens between cyanide gas and brick. And the argument made was, well, if the gas chambers in Birkenau were supposed to be gas chambers, why don't they have Prussian blue stains? And the answer is actually very simple, which is that because gassing typically took 15 minutes, not 24 hours, and afterwards the rooms were ventilated so that people could come in and drag the dead bodies out. So you just didn't have the contact between the brick and the gas in one place as you did in the other. Because Leuchter didn't take that into account, what he saw as being levels too low to prove gassing actually did exactly the opposite. It proved that the rooms had been exposed to hydrogen cyanide gas, which proved what had been said about the rooms, and that they were that the levels were lower than Leuchter thought they should be was immaterial, because we knew that they were just that the typical usage period for the rooms with the gas in them was, 1/24th by four, so whatever that 1/96th of the time. So the compounds were different. I mean, and so Leuchter ended up, because Leuchter is not a chemist and he's not an engineer, even though he presented himself as one, his undergraduate degree is in history of all things. He just didn't have the scientific expertise to know what he was talking about.
Yeah.
You know, it's interesting really quickly. I want to note, the court actually said to Leuchter, how do you function as an engineer if you don't have an engineering degree? And he responded, well, I would question, Your Honor, what an engineering degree is. I have a Bachelor of Arts degree, and I have the required background training both on the college level and in the field to perform my function as an engineer. And the court just responded, who determines that? You?
Yeah. Yeah, I know that. I know that that bit of the text. It's great. Yeah.
It sounds like he got trounced pretty hard, along with all these other characters we've talked about.
He got trounced really hard. When Irving came up, he brought in a guy named Germar Rudolph. Germar Rudolph is a German emigrated to the United States. He still lives in the U.S. as far as I know, in the Chicago area, I think. And he had a degree from the Max Planck Institute, or he had almost had a degree, because he attempted to write his dissertation about the impossibility of using cyanide gas to kill people. And so he got kicked out and finished without a degree. And so he provides the report supporting Irving's position that there's no gassing at Auschwitz. He provides the expert report in London. And the counter report, by the way, is supplied by a guy named Richard Green, who's a member of the Holocaust History Project, who's a PhD in physical chemistry and who worked for the CIA or the Department of Defense. I can't remember which one. But I mean, whose job basically it was to determine, like, the possibility of using certain gases in weaponry. This was the guy's job. But that report didn't get entered until after the judgment against Irving. So Irving is found, Deborah Lipstadt is found not guilty of libel, and now Irving's on the hook for her expenses, which are in the millions of dollars. And then Irving files an appeal, and he files a request to enter new evidence. He enters Rudolph's report, Deborah Lipstadt enters Richard Green's report, and then Irving withdraws his appeal. That's the end game that doesn't get talked about a lot, but that's literally what happened.
I was going to mention, too, I haven't done much research into the whole Irving Lipstadt trial, but I do know that at one point, one of the people who gave testimony is this odd figure known as Dr. Kevin McDonald, and he's an evolutionary psychologist who basically redresses anti-Semitic conspiracy theories up as evolutionary psych. He claims that Jews have a group evolutionary strategy, and he attacked Lipstadt in the trial on those ridiculous grounds. I mean, the trial sounds like a shit show.
Yeah, it definitely was. I mean, and McDonald is a fascinating character in his own right. He did really interesting. He's another one. Like, he did really interesting research on, I'm not an evolutionary psychologist, which is what he is. And there's a lot of people in evolutionary psychology with a lot of crazy ideas. Let's sort of put it there. But his basic idea, which had been published by mainstream presses, by the way, was Judaism is a group evolutionary strategy. Like, the extent to which Jews were managed to survive tremendous persecution by specific marriage patterns and wealth retention patterns. And those arguments, while unorthodox, are not overtly anti-Semitic or crazy. What happens is that he gets pushback, like enormous pushback, loses a publishing contract. And then, as I mentioned before, about Cardo looking to pick up, 18, 19-year-old boys who realize something's not right, with the country. The far right is waiting for Kevin MacDonald, and they are celebrating him as the guy who's really telling the truth and who's paying the price for it. And ever since, he's drifted further and further to the right. He's gotten involved in white nationalist politics. He was tenured at Cal State, I think Santa Barbara. So he retired with a normal, with a normal pension and everything. He never paid career sort of cost for what he was doing. And he also, by the way, is not a Holocaust denier. He believes that the Holocaust happened. He just thinks basically the Jews deserved it.
Yeah, he's a very odd figure. I've actually flipped through some pages of his books, and there's whole paragraphs where he'll go on about Hollywood movies like The Addams Family Values and Children of the Corn and say how it's a Jewish attack on the WASP establishment and how it's the Jews trying to destroy the Gentiles. I feel like, I don't know, maybe when he was a hippie activist in the 60s, maybe he just took a little bit too much acid or something, but wow, that guy's just out there.
Yeah, he's out there.
So, Marlon, I want to kick it over to you. As we wrap up here, I want to ask, why do you think this topic is still so important? I mean, we've covered a few cases. It seems like a lot of these characters, like Irving, like Luchter, they end up, getting their just desserts in the end. Why do you think it's important that we still keep pushing back on this, not just for the historical record, which I think is important in and of itself?
Yeah, well, I think Dr. Mathis touched on it at one point a little earlier, the idea that these ideas are often in service, they're not often in service to truth, they're often in service to rehabilitating other ideas. Holocaust denial makes fascism okay, or if not okay, at least an option. Because as it is now, we often think, well, fascism can never be an option because of the Holocaust. Plenty of other ideologies have bad things have been committed in their name, or they've had terrible experiences. But because the Holocaust is beyond the pale and fascism is not a political option, which I agree with. And right now, there is these sort of networks, like you mentioned with Chuck Johnson and Goetz, they're becoming a lot more porous. The distinctions between the far right and who is in mainstream conservative politics all around the world. You see it a lot in the Baltic states and Eastern Europe. There's tons of Holocaust now. It's just suffused with it. And so that's why I think it's important. It's not just a historical question. History can be useful material for justifying politics today. And if Holocaust now gains further currency, as it has in a distressing amount of places, there will be consequences to it.
And also we have the generation that has a living memory of the Holocaust. They are passing into the realm of history now. Those people are dying off, and we have new generations that don't have that same living memory of the event.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's a really vital point as well. And so the extent to which there's going to be people that can directly refute what Holocaust deniers are saying on the basis of what they personally saw is getting smaller and smaller, obviously, all the time. And we're at the tail end of those people that were alive at the time and of an age where they're able to remember, you know, not tiny children, for instance. And now those people are beginning to pass away as well, and it's distressing, you know. So it's really sort of important that we keep a responsible presentation of the history alive and going, because we, as the people in the historical community, are going to be the only people that are going to be able to make any argument about it whatsoever relatively soon.
Well, Dr. Mathis, do you think that, you know, these Holocaust deniers, and I don't know much, are there still sort of a new breed of these people? I should probably ask that first. What is the new breed like? Have there been more of these people cropping up since Irving? Who's the next generation?
I think that the Irving trial was a high watermark. So, and I think that there's been fewer and fewer Holocaust deniers or sort of new ones coming down the road since he lost. That said, he also he went on trial before September 11th. And so now, after the September 11th attacks, there's a sort of like a confluence of events. There's a September 11th attack. There's a second intifada in Israel. And those events, the first just via pure conspiracy theory, and the second just, you know, with some conspiracy thrown into actual observation of Israeli policy, now has fueled another round of revitalized anti-Semitism. But where it has emerged is a little bit strange. I would argue that so some people basically have made the argument over the course of the last decade or two decades rather, that there is a quote unquote new anti-Semitism that has emerged on the left as a result of beliefs about Jews or Israel or some combination being involved in the September 11th attacks and, demonstrating dual loyalty as far as Israel is concerned, and all these sort of tropes that you've heard when it's entered the sort of the mainstream discourse. And I would argue that it's actually not on the left at all, that the people that are doing it began on the political left, but very much like in the case of Cardo talking about before, or Michael Collins Piper, that these people, upon becoming sort of politically active, they drifted into anti-Zionism, which in and of itself, you know, is not anti-Semitic, but has, you know, probably more than its fair share of anti-Semitic people bouncing around in that particular orbit, are able to pull some number of people away from the left generally, because, you know, the left is an ideology that's based on equality, not hierarchy, and based on progressive change rather than the undergirding of old traditions, right? So I mean, it's where the churches had always been, so it's where the right is where the churches had always been, so the right was always where anti-Semitism was. And I would argue that it still is. It's just that where those people on the right who are always lying in wait to find sort of souls that are conducive or open to hearing an anti-Semitic message, where they've done most of the recruiting over the course of the last two decades is in the anti-Zionist left. And that once people like that end up drifting away from the reasons that they went into that movement to begin with and begin voicing ridiculous conspiracy theories, including Holocaust denial, then they've ended up on the right, in the very least in spirit, if not in, you know, sort of strict taxonomy.
Wasn't there a figure recently who was sort of on the younger end of Holocaust denial that finally just admitted to the reality of it? I'm blanking on the name. Eric something?
Yeah, it's Eric Hunt. Eric Hunt. The people who are in this are just – they are just – endlessly fascinating. So Eric Hunt became famous because he accosted Elie Wiesel in an elevator in San Francisco 15 years ago. And he ended up being tried and convicted of assault, and he went to prison. because he was trying to get Elie Wiesel to prove that he had no tattoo on his arm. This is Eric Hunt that did this. And in a way, it's kind of sad because, I mean, Eric is very clearly somebody that has struggled with mental illness, which is not at all funny and not at all a joke. But the way that it kind of has evinced itself is in believing in anti-Semitic conspiracy theories. So he got out of prison and he finished his parole and probation, rather. And when he was done, he resurfaced in the Holocaust denial movement with, you know, sort of like reinvigorated, and began doing a lot of research and looking at a lot of issues that he had not looked at very closely before then. And about 2 years ago, he just threw his hands up and said, I'm done, guys. I've looked at the evidence and I was wrong. I still hate the Jews. This is like, you know, the Mark Weber messaging about Holocaust and I, like, or Irving for that matter. Like, I still am an anti-Semite, but this part of it, I basically have to walk away from because it doesn't stand up to scrutiny if you're at all willing to look dispassionately at the evidence. And so, yeah, he renounced, and he's kind of gone underground since then. I don't really know what he's been up to since then because, you know, he's not important to the things that I do now that he's not denying the Holocaust. But yeah, he's the most recent case of somebody that just publicly renounced and walked away from it. And it was that he was already famous for a couple of strange things that he had done probably didn't help to make his message reverberate outside of the very small community that I find myself in. But it was a very interesting case nevertheless.
Before we close out, I just wanted to say one of the things that really annoys me and just upsets me about Holocaust denial is that I think there is reason to still think very deeply about the reality of the Holocaust. I'm a big fan, and I've mentioned it on the show before, of Zygmunt Bauman, the sociologist, and his book, Modernity and the Holocaust, as well as Adorno's writings on education after the Holocaust. And I think their meditations on the topic raise really distressing questions about, you know, how as a society do you really go forward after this kind of event? I mean, it was an event in which industrial society was used to basically create mass death. How do you teach civics and civic duty in a world where that has happened? I think it's still an issue, this event in history that is, you know, mind-boggling on a merely emotional level. And I think it just makes you question, how could this happen and how can we never let it happen again? If either of you want to comment on that, maybe you first, Marlon.
Yeah, I agree with everything you're saying. I don't have a very good answer to the question, unfortunately. I think the reason why we remember the Holocaust is probably similar to why people deny the Holocaust. Because it was such like a rupture in what we thought was the course of history, this sort of idea that
of endless progress, since the Enlightenment, yeah.
Exactly. It was sort of the apex of that. It proved there was this sort of perversely, it was, you know, you read Adorno, the apex of the Enlightenment, or, and people have a hard time reconciling it. I don't think that the explanation that some people put forward, that Holocaust deniers just don't want it to be true, is very valid. I think the reasons are more like the ones we've discussed, but it's interesting how when you read more and more about the Holocaust, you don't want it to be true. I remember about 6 years ago, when I had a really deep interest in all this, I was reading the Nuremberg trial transcripts, and I just got to a point where I did not want to read any more about it. And I stopped engaging at all with the history, which isn't the same as denying it, but it is almost forgetting about it. I didn't want to think about it. And I think as we struggle with memory and denial, we can sometimes get to that place where it's overwhelming. But I don't have a good answer to the initial question so much.
Yeah, I would say that A couple of things. First of all, I would say that I think that to a certain extent, the message that comes out of Bauman and I guess to a lesser extent Adorno, although I have issues with some of the stuff that he says as well, like just to make that point a little bit more thorough, like with the idea of the that art after the Holocaust is barbarism, seems to me to fail to recognize an important point, which is one of the ways that we're able to process it is through art, and that's an important sort of distinction. But from Bauman, the idea of modernity being sort of implicit as a kind of a co-conspirator in the way that things unfold, I think is a point well taken, but it overlooks the idea that what happened in the Holocaust is a difference of a difference in scale, but not in kind, of the mass persecution. And so we can only pin so much of it on modernity. We can pin on modernity that it took certain industrial forms, or that in the case of the death camps process, that it took on a kind of assembly line format almost. And that has its own dehumanizing effects, of course. But the urge that underlies it, the belief that it's necessary under certain circumstances to completely eradicate a group of people, that's not new. You know, that's a very old belief and urge, and sadly, it's not something that began or ended with the Holocaust. We had the Armenian genocide 25 years earlier, and the Rwandan genocide 50 years after. I mean, and those are just the most famous examples. There's obviously far more examples that could be given, and people would be hard pressed, I think, to say that modernity was a significant aspect, at least in terms of the way that certain aspects of modernity, being the way that they give rise to the Holocaust, are as equally applicable in the cases of the Armenians or the case of the Rwandans. Now, the larger philosophical question, which is it the defeat, ultimate defeat of Enlightenment thinking? I think that there's a point to be made about that, but I think, again, you find a more informative answer in looking at where the movements that end up carrying out genocidal actions, which is to say radical integral nationalism, where does that emerge and why? And yes, it comes with the recognition of the failure of the Enlightenment, but it happens a hell of a lot earlier than 1942, or for that matter, 1915. I would argue that it really begins to happen in 1848, and then really, really happens in 1871 with the defeat of the Paris Commune.
Well, I guess in closing, since this is a roundtable, I want to get everyone's final comments. I think I sort of gave my final comments, and I appreciate some of your critical views on Bauman and Adorno, Dr. Mathis. I appreciate that greatly. Just final comments, Marlon, and then Dr. Mathis.
I think I've made my final comments, actually. I'm not sure if I have anything to add now.
Is there anything you would like to add, Dr. Mathis, before we part ways?
Just that I think that it's, unfortunately, what we've found over the course of the last few years, not just in the United States, but really all over the world, but very particularly in Europe, is that this isn't anywhere near over. I mean, we're going to have to continue doing this for a while. There was, I think, a lot of false hope after the Irving trial that the big fight had been won and it was going to go away. And that clearly is not the case. I mean, it's going to continue. And that's, sobering, obviously, but it's better to understand that and move forward accordingly. And I guess that's really all I would say about it as well.
That does make me think of something, actually, though. And it was when you were asking JG about who are the new ones. I hadn't thought. I've seen a lot of Holocaust denial among younger people or people on the internet or young figures, but something, and Dr. Mathis made me realize that I haven't seen, is there's no new research, there's no developments in Holocaust denial, which, the fact that it still exists is concerning, but the fact that there hasn't been a new Luchter report or a new, Irving trial probably is a good sign.
I agree, actually. That's an excellent point. I mean, there really has been no new, there are no new, you know, young, fresh faces on the scene. I mean, the best that they had was Eric Hunt. He was problematic to begin with for the reasons that I laid out, and, you know, he's gone his own way. So otherwise, it's a very much a graying field with no new blood. So that's definitely a plus. I would agree with that.
Dr. Mathis, it just brought to mind what you said. I was listening to your appearance on the great Matt Bender's Doomed podcast.
Yes.
And you sort of mentioned at the end that you felt, or you feel, I don't know if you maybe still feel this way, that we're maybe seeing the last gasps of the sort of white nationalist insurgents. Do you still feel that way now, or maybe was I misinterpreting your comments, or if you could clarify there?
Yeah, sure. I think we're seeing the last gasp for this country. I don't think we're seeing the last gasp for it in Europe. I think it's a long way off in Europe. I think that demographics is just – it dictates that it can't go on this way forever in this country, because it's not going to be a white country anymore. I mean, and the ability of white power – white people in power to maintain systems of oppression against non-white people of growing number is going to be eroded over the course of time. And there are enough smart people in the right places in this country, I truly believe, to recognize that there's one of two ways that this can end, and the better way for it to end is for people to get on the same side of things and work together rather than continue to tear the fabric of the country apart. I think that the Trump movement is so when I was saying to Matt that I feel like it's the last gasp, I'm sort of directly identifying that with the movement of people that are supporting Trump, who I think the older generation are lost. I think the younger generation is salvageable, but I think it's going to take a lot of work. But I do believe that we're in the last gasps in this country. But again, for Europe, I think it's a lot of pain ahead for them because they have not they haven't sort of they have come to terms with history for one thing, but they've also chosen paths. The people that govern the countries in Europe have chosen paths that have made these issues worse rather than better. Particularly, things like austerity, for instance, or blame shifting for economic downturns. And half of these countries never really dealt with the fall of communism, and now they're chickens are coming home to roost as a result of that, and they're just they're poorly equipped to manage the transition. So it's the circumstances are different there rather than here. I'm more hopeful for here, but there's always the possibility that they can change course in Europe as well.
I would just add to that, I think even if we are in the last gasps of this white nationalist sort of insurgency in the United States, I don't think that necessarily means we should breathe easy, because I think white nationalists in this country are going to get violent and put up a fight. I don't know if you'd agree with that. Yeah.
No. I definitely agree with that. I think that I think that we're gonna see violence for a while. I think that we'll have a much better idea of where things are heading after the election, obviously. But I don't imagine that the Trump movement just disappears. It's going to continue to rear its head in different ways. But I do think that, and I certainly hope that it's the case, that if Trump loses a second term, that takes a pretty big bite out of their energy and mobilization. And I also hope, frankly, that the messaging from both parties can then be both more conciliatory, but also can more recognize the underlying socioeconomic crises that have put the younger generation into this particular bin of people supporting Trump, as opposed to the older, who are genuinely sort of racially panicked and sort of not really redeemable, therefore by experiencing a better socioeconomic condition through some policy other than austerity, basically.
Well, I want to thank both of you, Marlon Ettinger and Dr. Andrew Mathis, for having this really informative and I think important and insightful conversation on the issue of Holocaust denial. Thank you once again.
Thanks for having me.
Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views.
I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Dr. Andrew Mathis, aka Thames Darwin, and Marlon Ettinger on the subject of Holocaust denial and its strange history. As always, let me know what you thought about this edition of Parallax Views by dropping me a line on Twitter at ViewsParallax or by email at ParallaxViewsPod@protonmail.com. Also, if you can, please consider supporting me on Patreon at patreon.com/ParallaxViews. Many thanks to the Radio War Nerd community. A number of members of the Radio War Nerd community recently kicked me some funds on Patreon. And if you're unfamiliar with Radio War Nerd, check out the show on Patreon hosted by Mark Ames and John Dolan, two figures who I will proudly admit were a great influence on me, especially in my college years. They provide some really great analysis and have a hard edge that has influenced me greatly over the years. And with that being said, until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views. To Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say, don't do it, just to prohibit. It's nothing else. If we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxieties, problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight with no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.